Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 172. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I'm going to keep the intro brief this week. I've got a lot to tell you about my recent trip to New York, the podcast I recorded there, the stuff that went down, New York and LA. But I'm going to put that all at the end, because we've got a big guest this week, and it's Michael Fassbender, and I think that's going to bring one or two listeners who aren't regular listeners and might not want to be bored with my stories of my trips. I know you regular listeners, the millions of you who already tune in, always want to hear my boring stories, but a few of the new guys might not, so I'm going to be respectful of that and do a long outro and a short intro. If this is your first time, though, you might want to check out some previous episodes. Or first of all, welcome, 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 and thank you for tuning in. But you might want to check some previous episodes. We've had a James McAvoy, who obviously stars alongside Michael Fassbender in the X-Men movies. I've had Paddy Considine, who starred alongside Michael in Macbeth. I've had people like Simon Pegg, Stephen Graham, loads of really good actors and actresses. Kathy Burke, some really good people. So have a scroll through the back catalogue and see if any appeal. I had Eddie Izzard a couple of weeks ago, and it's a really good episode. So check them out. This was a great one. I didn't want to announce it until it had actually been recorded, but because I was approached to have Michael on, and I'm a big fan. I think he's great, so I was very excited about that. But, you know, I don't like to hype things until they're in the bag, so I kept quiet on it. I'm going to just stop talking and let us get into it. If you are new, you should also, this will be the first time you hear me say, everyone else has heard this every episode, that this week's podcast is brought to you by Speech Development Records, which is my record label, where you can buy Distraction Pieces podcast merch, you can buy CDs, DVDs, and all sorts of stuff. This is a big episode, and at the beginning I just like kind of hiccuped as I was speaking. It's always this ramshackle. You might just want to listen to this one and never tune in again. But it was great to talk to Michael, and it was a true honour because he was doing a press run and I believe he only had 4 hours, and they gave me 45 minutes of it, which is massive. You know, the people who were in after me was like a round table of 20 journalists or something, all getting to talk at once. So it meant the world that they trust me enough to give me this time, and we really hit it off, and I think we had a really good chat. So I'm going to let you be the judge of that. But what I will mention is that The Snowman comes out this Friday, October 13th, in cinemas all over the UK. I believe it's the week after in the US, so check that out. So yeah, I'll be back at the end, but for now, this is Distraction Pieces Podcast, episode 172, with Michael Fassbender. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. It's hopefully a relief from the short, quick ones you're having to do, and we can have a bit more of a in-depth conversation.
So, I love it.
I'm joined by Michael Fassbender. How are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. You've got to be one of the busiest men in this industry at the moment. So are you keeping well? Are you looking after yourself?
Actually, you know what? This year I haven't done much. I mean, I just finished shooting X-Men, but for the rest of the year I took off.
Yeah,
and that's been great.
And that's a character you've got to know. I was looking. I mean, I'm a fan of your work over the years, and I was kind of doing a bit of research leading up to this, and I noticed that in the last 10 years, you've done at least 2 to 4 films every year for the last 10 years, which seems like an insane amount to get through, considering how long these projects take. So that's...
Yeah, I think, I don't know, fear of death or something. I'm not sure what. I had a lot of appetite for the work.
Yeah, and when the opportunities come up, I guess, it's something to jump upon and sink your teeth into.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. I always just thought I'd go hell for leather until I'm 40 and then, you know, reassess things from there. And I've really enjoyed it. Like I say, I had a, you know, I just feel like I had the appetite for it. And now this year I've taken the year off and I have an appetite for taking time off.
What do you do to fill that time? What are you?
I've been surfing a lot and racing Ferraris.
Amazing. Well, that's good ways to fill your time, isn't it?
No, if you've ridiculous. Got time off. Absolutely it's better than ridiculous.
It's sitting around on the sofa.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we'll talk about a lot of stuff, but we've got to start off with The Snowman, which I've just seen and absolutely I loved it. How was that to take on? Because it's kind of... It occurred to me there's not really been many kind of mysteries and thrillers in cinema in recent years. There's been an awful lot in TV with, and particularly Scandinavian with The Bridge and The Killing and all these kind of things. But it, as it was unfolding, it was exciting to see that I don't see this on the big screen that often. So.
No, you're right. I was talking to somebody about this recently as well. You know, in the 80s, you had a lot of these kind of films.
Yeah.
You know, Science of the Lambs, that might even be early 90s or whatever. But you're right, that sort of genre is... we don't see a lot of it nowadays.
It's been replaced like with a lot more action, I think it feels. Like there'll still be some thrillers, but the thrillers will be action-packed rather than tension-packed, which this certainly was.
Well, I think, you know, the landscape of cinema has changed an awful lot in terms of, like, people like you and I, the sort of films that maybe we'd go see, or that age bracket from 25 up.
Yeah.
People are watching a lot of things at home because the home entertainment systems are so good. And, you know, people, you know, if people have kids, they've got to get babysitters, they've got to drive to the cinema, and then, cinema's quite expensive. You got to park the car, all these things. Whereas now you can sit at home and have the sort of luxury of just being at home with a great system at home.
Yeah.
And that's why we've seen the evolution of television over, you know, the last 10 years or whatever it's been since The Sopranos. So, yeah, I think the landscape's just changed a lot.
It certainly seems to have opened people up to take a greater risks, because there is that freedom of people can watch it at any time. It's not that... Obviously, there's still a level of pressure with big blockbusters or whatever else, but there's not as much pressure of, we need to get that first weekend hit.
Absolutely,
and that's
right.
It. There's that...
Absolutely,
well,
right.
This is now... You can do a project that's got depth and character and not just here's five big names and a big trailer.
The opening weekend, as you say, you know, which it sort of very much is about with films and cinema.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, things like The Wire, you know, can sort of take its time. And even though it wasn't getting maybe the views that it should have been getting in the first year, it became a cult sort of classic and people started tuning into it years down the line. So, you know, that's... It's a different medium in that respect, and it allows for that a lot more.
Yeah, of course. So was Harry Hole an exciting character to take on? Because there's a lot of stories there, which is exciting, I'd imagine. From obviously you've got this one here, but it's a load of Joe Nesbo books, and he's a character that's got a lot of depth and history. So was that something that added to the appeal of
to be honest with you,
a lot of adventures?
Yeah, to be honest with you, the first appeal was working with Thomas, because I'd met him for Tinker Tailor, and I was shooting X-Men First Class at the time, and the schedules kind of clashed, so we didn't get an opportunity to work together on that. So I'd always remembered that meeting, and of course then I'd seen Let the Right One In, and then watched, you know, Tinker Tailor after our meeting. And I just always thought, you know, wow, I would have, you know, really liked to work with that guy. So when he came back with this, I was like, fantastic, here's the opportunity. And then I loved the sort of the premise of of this character and this world. Read the script, responded to it, and then started reading the books. And that was my first introduction to the books.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wow, this character is great. You know, there's... He's such a sort of, you know, he's not like your, you know, he's definitely not like a diehard type cop, you know.
Yeah,
when he gets into a tussle, he ends up coming out the worst for wear. I like that. There was something very funny about it.
Yeah.
You know, he always sort of ends up with this, you know, physically he walks away with the memory of that case, you know, whether it's like he gets his ear chopped off or whatever it is.
Yeah,
you know,
there's, of course.
So there was something that I really liked about, endearing about that. And then the fact that he's kind of this sort of oddball, sort of antisocial sort of character. He's got one friend, I think, in the book that he sort of goes back to. And he's very much his own person. I think that's very attractive.
Yeah.
Even though he's a mess in terms of his drinking habits, he knows himself.
Yeah.
And he's not lying to himself.
That's one of the things I liked about it, was it's not the cliche, oh, he's a maverick cop, he's a bit of a drunk, because he never has that moment of I'm the big hero. He has he resolves things. He is clearly the lead, but he will fall short and it'll go wrong and go up and down. It's not this kind of, oh, he was on the ropes,
he's a maverick,
then he's
on
pulled
the
it
edge.
Out exactly. It's like he's pulled it back out of nowhere. It's like, no, he's barely pulled it back. He's lost a bit of it, kind of thing, you know.
Plus, he's intelligent, you know. There's an intelligence to him. He uses his brain more than he uses his brawn, that's for sure. And I like that. Again, it's not Columbo, but, you know, it's kind of, there's something quirky about it, rather than this sort of, you know, action hero type character.
Completely. And it's a character that I'm liking this. It's popping up more and more in film and TV at the moment, where there are these intelligent characters who are the ones who are kind of writing the world off. Because in reality, a lot of the state of the world, the more intelligent you are, the more you can see, the more you're going to be that guy who's like, I'm just going to drink this away.
That's right.
Because the world isn't in the best a position as such.
You know what? I was working on a job many, many years ago in Canada, this film called Bear Named Winnie, and the gaffer said to me, if you had one wish, you know, what would it be? And I was, or maybe it was three, whatever. So I was like, health, obviously, that's the first one, you know. And
take that.
And then I said, to be really smart. And he was like, no. He was like, you want to be sort of ignorant. Because the smarter you are, you realize how little you know, and in some ways the more tortured you could become.
Yeah.
Whereas if you sort of walk around sort of ignorance is bliss, as they say, you know.
Yeah, it's completely true. My favorite quote is from Jimmy Stewart in Harvey. Mm-hmm. And he says, my mother always said to me, in this world, Elwood, you can be oh so smart or oh so pleasant. For years I was smart. I recommend pleasant.
Yeah.
And it's perfect. It is exactly that. It's that level of smartness can be your downfall in the end. And
you know, I think that's one of the reasons, you know, I was always like, what is it with Harry and the drinking? And I think he just wants to, you know, numb it out, you know, shut down the computer in his head because it's going all the time.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, he tends to sober up when he's got something that requires his full attention, like a serial killer on the loose. Otherwise, he's just trying to turn the engine off.
That's what I like, though, that hunger for something to chase as such, because it is
a worthy adversary,
where there isn't much going on, and it is these quiet towns. It's what made Fargo so great, and what made The Killing so great, and things like that, where it is these towns where there's not much happening, and then when it does, it's a bigger question of if people can rise to the occasion. It's not a New York cop who's seeing this all the time.
That's right.
You're in the middle of nowhere and you're waiting for this one thing to.
You do think to yourself, my God, there's a lot of serial killers in Norway and Scandinavia.
it's true.
It's the serial capital of the world.
It is. I mean, you mentioned a Let the Right One In being something you saw and was appealing, and the cinematography in that is something that's beautiful and amazing, with the snowy landscapes, and that's what comes into this film as well. Mm-hmm. Just these, I think it's Oslo and Bergen. It's set,
that's right,
isn't it? And just the vastness of these landscapes, and the comfort of a confident director to allow those to breathe at points and not kind of have to fill it with action packed movement constantly. The first big chunk of the film is quite slow paced, and you are just taking in this. Imagine having to exist in this icy world. And I mean, it makes a character like Harry all the more dangerous in a way, because a drunk on the streets in Oslo is more likely to die than a drunk on the streets in LA.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean? Because it's ice cold and it's freezing. So, how was that to be out there and work in those conditions?
Definitely, you know, I loved it. It was... Macbeth was way worse in terms of the weather.
Yeah.
You know, that was definitely weather-wise the worst conditions that all of us experienced, like the crew as well. You know,
yeah.
Crew members that have been working on films for 30 years were like, whoa. You know, whether it was when we were up in Skye or down just outside London, there was a lot of flooding that year. So just the driving rain. And there's something about, you know, the dampness with the cold that gets into your bones.
But did that of all the projects for that to feel appropriate for, surely Macbeth was the perfect one.
Well, we were like, it's going to look great.
You're meant to be damned and in pain and
exactly,
broken.
Exactly. We were like, well, this should lend it. Yeah. it's the thing about Norway is you got that dry cold.
Yeah.
So it's quite refreshing. I loved
sharpness.
Yeah, there's a sharpness to it. I felt great. There was one or two nights where Oleg, who's Raquel, Harry's ex-girlfriend, her son, were there out sort of going to see this concert. That was cold that night. I think that was the coldest it got. I can't remember exactly what it was. Maybe minus 20 or something like that. And again, because it's nighttime, it was pretty chilly. But other than that, I really enjoyed it. I actually got to ski for the first time in my life.
Oh, wow.
Which must have made the producers a little nervous.
I was saying, that was allowed when weren't on a filming schedule and the
allowed,
risk of injuring yourself.
Sure. But, you know, I thought, hey, come on, we're right beside this snow piece. I got to give it a go. And I loved it, yeah.
I was working with Stephen Graham on a project.
I worked with him years ago.
A year or so ago, and he'd just finished Pirates of the Caribbean. He was saying it was the best because a week in, a Johnny Depp injured himself, which meant they just all had a month off in
the Caribbean.
They were like, well, we can't shoot for a month, but there's no point in sending us all home. We've got it all here.
So were they on an island? You didn't go crazy after a while?
They were off somewhere nice, but Stevie, he got to bring his family out and all that kind of. He was like, this is perfect. We just got it. It was like, I'm gutted. It's all held up. And yeah, this isn't ideal, if I'm honest, but we'll try. It's like, great, but yeah, that's a risky one to go skiing in the middle of.
It is. I promised them I'd be careful
for the first time.
Yeah, I guess so. It was. I was careful as you can be, I guess, skiing for the first time.
Of course. So, does the traveling part of it appeal to you in acting? Because again, you've done a lot of roles that seem to be in all sorts of climates and locations. Is that something that motivates in that way?
Yeah, you know, I love going to different places, and it's not like, let's say, going on a holiday somewhere, because you're working with local crews.
Yeah.
You've got the local knowledge.
Yeah.
So you experience cities and countries in a very specific way, the best way you're going to experience them. And then also, you end up in places that you might never go to. You know, like Between Oceans, we're in a place called Cape Campbell, which was a very isolated part of northeast coast of New Zealand.
Oh, wow.
And stunning and beautiful.
Yeah.
A couple of films have taken me to Romania and countryside spots in Romania and just lots of different places. And again, you get sort of a fast track into seeing what the real culture is like.
Because you're going out with the crew. You've got such emptiness and vastness at points that you need to kind of know where you're going as such.
That's
to stumble upon the right.
And just in general, you know, if you're going to a place for 2 weeks and that's the great thing about the internet now. You can really sort of research and find things. You know, whether it be Lonely Planet Timeout or any of these things as well, you can get a sort of idea, but you still never get that local plug-in, you know. And
makes all the difference.
And that's really one of the great perks about traveling and moving with the job. But also, you know, I get apartments as opposed to staying in hotels.
Yeah.
Because to try and set up some, you know, feeling of a home while you're there.
Of home and a base rather than a room that you've never really unpacked your bags. And
that's right. Because I've done that too. Yeah.
Did you travel a lot as a kid?
No.
Because you grew up in Ireland, right? Mm. Were you born in Germany or
I was born in Germany, yeah. We moved to Ireland when I was two. So we did that crossing a lot to Germany.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was kind of the only really holidays. We used to take holidays up to Northern Ireland and then back to Germany to see the relatives there. But when I left drama school, because that was, you know, obviously you pay for the fees and everything, I didn't really take any holidays at that point.
No.
But as soon as I could and as soon as I had money, I went, you know, and started traveling places, South America, and whenever I could get away, I did.
Yeah. What was the route, or was acting always the goal growing up in Ireland, because Ireland has got very much a, an enclosed kind of TV and film industry and things like that. There's a lot of amazing drama and TV made, but very much made by Ireland for Ireland. And then it tends to be everyone I know who's come from that era ventures out of it to find the broader industry as such.
Well, I guess, you know, it just sort of happened. I started when I realized I wanted to do acting when I was 17. And then a friend of mine, Eoin O'Shea, had gone off to Cork to do a media studies course there at Cláiste de Stéphán Naofa. And he said to me, hey, listen, because I was thinking at that point, I was like, what am I going to do? I just directed some friends in a play of Reservoir Dogs, but everybody had gone off to university.
Yeah.
And I was sort of still in Killarney. And I was actually going to go and work in hotels and go traveling maybe. You know, a friend of mine, Dad, had a hotel in Austria, and I was going to see maybe I could work in the kitchen there.
Yeah.
Didn't really know what I was going to do. And Eoin called up and he said, look, there's a theater course here. Come, you know, why don't you come check it out? So I did. They accepted me. And then my teacher, Mary Mulcahy, suggested that I go train properly.
Yeah.
And then I went to audition Bristol Old Vic, Central School of Speech and Drama, and Drama Centre, all, you know, in London, those two were. And I got accepted into Drama Centre, and that was it. Then I moved over here. And then here was the base for me, and I just sort of took it from there.
So the kind of starting point of your career, again, it was the same for a mutual friend of ours who I think had said he went to school with you, Mr. Tom Hardy.
Yes.
Kick things off in Band of Brothers. And it's one of them films that I seem to constantly find people that I'm a fan of and go, oh, were they in that? Like, Tom was one of them. I didn't remember him in there.
Yeah, but he has a small thing, but he really pops out in it,
right.
I thought he did a fantastic job in Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was recognised quickly, I think, by the industry. And, you know, he did that then very quickly. He did the film Star Trek Nemesis.
Yes, of course.
And then I think he went back to theatre and did a lot of that. And then, you know...
And brought it all together in Bronson and stuff like
that. That's right. Tom was 2 years behind me.
Right.
So I was in my third year, I think, and he was in the first year.
Right.
Or maybe he was only 1 year behind. Anyway, he left by the end of the first year to do Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
And then we met again on that.
Yeah.
And then sort of crossed paths then through the years.
Amazing. So the one that kind of seemed to, I mean, you did a lot of TV, and again, I love the kind of traditional British route of there's a lot of them specific kind of crime programs on TV and stuff like that people get to earn their stripes on and learn their way. But the one that seemed to just quite rightfully thrust you into the forefront was Hunger, which was absolutely amazing. And how was that to take on playing such an important character and in an important role and part of history, obviously growing up in Ireland and visiting Northern Ireland a lot.
Yeah, I was shitting it. Can I say that?
I can imagine. Yeah, you can. Yeah, we're completely free. It's the podcast world. We can do what we want.
Yes. Yeah, I was really, you know, nervous. You know, my mum comes from Larne.
Yeah.
Like I say, all my, all my Irish relatives are from the north. So, you know, we used to always go up and down there and, obviously very in touch with the troubles there. And I just wanted to make sure that we were respecting that subject matter, you know.
Yeah.
And as soon as I met Steve McQueen, I just knew I had to work with him.
Yeah.
I thought it went really well, that first meeting. I found out subsequently he didn't like me at all.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it was Gary Davey, the casting director, you know, who said, no, listen, get him back in. To read, you know, because that was just an initial meeting. He was like, this is the guy, you know, I think you're gonna agree with me. And then I came in and I did the reading, and then, you know, it went from there. You know, Steve, they sort of offered it to me after that.
Amazing. I love that. I love the, I think people can underestimate at times the importance of getting on with an impressing the room in casting.
Yeah, I wasn't very good at that.
But you did with Gary. Obviously, you obviously got that. You made the impression on the casting director, and that's such an important thing. I think people always would assume to be focused on that director or that writer or that producer. And the casting director, as you just declared, is the one that, that fought your call and went, no, look, I've seen this guy. He can, he's got this.
Absolutely. You know, I really have to thank him. He, you know, and he, that was from back, you know, I'd met him on Bad and Brothers, you know, yeah. Gary Davey. And so he had just sort of, you know, continued to sort of champion me, which was literally 8 years later.
Wow. Yeah, of course.
So it was it's pretty cool.
Amazing. So another film, I'm honestly not going to go through your entire back catalogue, but I'll pick some. But I live in a town called Stanfordly Hope,
yeah,
which is one train stop from Tilbury,
okay,
which is where Fish Tank, or the girl from Fish Tank, was found on Tilbury train station.
That's right.
In all our local papers at the time. So, so how was that to work on and to be part of? Because, again, it was another
it's a great film.
Amazing, gritty story that... Just the realness of it, the confidence of a director to go, no, there is story and there is obviously drama and tension, but allowing a lot of it to just be, she's real.
She's great. You know, yeah. Andrea is just a real proper filmmaker. She's a proper artist. And and she loves chaos and can harness it. You know, some directors cause chaos and can't really harness it. But she really does that very well, and she likes things to be unpredictable. So, for example, you know, I never got a full script of Fish Tank.
Wow.
She wanted to give me the lines the day before, and I was like, no, don't do that because I'll never learn them in time. You know, I like to sort of learn the lines and then let them rot. So I would get the week's shooting at the weekend before, and I could do my work then over the weekend and then take it sort of day by day.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of improvisation. We did a lot of sort of silent takes, you know, and Katie was just a natural, you know, and she was great to work opposite. And all of the cast, you know, Kirsten, the environment we were working in, Robbie Ryan on the camera as well. He's fantastic. And just she captures this sort of reality and grittiness and... just life in its ugliness and beauty at the same time.
Because it is an ugly story being told, I guess, in many ways. But it's at no point does it look as if it's looking down on anyone.
No, it's not judgmental.
It's very much there, going, look, here's just how things are. Some of it is shitty, and some of it is beautiful.
That's right.
Kind of it's finding those bits in there.
That's right, and sometimes they're working. Parallel, it's one of my favorite films that I've done.
It's great. Well, I mean, then after I finally convinced a Mr. McQueen, you got you obviously won him over hugely, because then you worked together on Shame, and that was again another film that I loved watching in the cinema, and it really. The thing that jumped out at me in your performance of it was it felt like a standout and a real career-defining moment of a performance. But for so many actors, that performance is the one where they're being bombastic and over the top. And the thing that stood out for me in that performance was your restraint and the amount of silence and the amount of just looks and getting it all across in tiny nuances and subtleties rather than... Here's my character, and it is a shocking character and a conflicting story, and you know a lot of stuff there that's going to make you uncomfortable as a viewer. But it's done with such a subtlety. It felt like it must have been a great one to work on and be.
You know, again, work. We shot it in 25 days too, so it was pretty.
Oh, wow.
It was pretty. It was intense. But then he shot 12 Years a Slave in 35 days, which is incredible with one camera, pretty much.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's all Steve. But but the thing with Brandon in Shame was I wanted this guy that was almost like it was a coiled spring.
Yeah.
You know, all the time. It's just at some point it's just going to, you know, unleash.
Yeah.
But it's always sort of restrained and held back. And just, you know, again, working with the closeness of with Steve, Sean Bobbitt behind the camera, we've developed, you know, really... great understanding.
Yeah.
And just again, you know, what's a big deal is the dance between the camera and the actor, and
yeah,
the rhythms that you create together.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, it's you can see it in all of Steve's films. He gets great performances out of it, all of the actors.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody's sort of at their top level with him. And it's, yeah, Brandon was a really tough sort of character, just because, yeah, you know, of all of that psychological torture that's going on, and having met, you know, sex addict in New York, to sort of get an understanding of that fear of intimacy was very disturbing. And it's what's, I suppose, interesting about that addiction is, you know, sex is something that we're all predisposed to in such a primal way because we have to procreate and
recreate. And that is championed as well. Yeah. You know, it's one of the few addictions that is so championed, and everyone's, you know, your mates will nudge you. And
that's right. That's right.
Good work, well done, kind of thing.
Yeah.
Pat on the back.
But what's strange about it is when you develop an unhealthy relationship with it and you have to step back from it, it's sort of like food as well. People that develop an unhealthy relationship with food, these are things that we need, you know. It's like alcohol, we don't need it, you know. They're external things, gambling, maybe the same, but these things are sort of intrinsic in our makeup. And that's what makes it such a complicated addiction.
Because it's not one that you can say, right, I'm going to cut this out now and go cold turkey and never have alcohol again. It's like, well, it's not realistic to go cold turkey on sex or, as said, on food. It's one that it's ones that you need to. It's like trying to get over an alcohol addiction, but you have to have a couple of shots every day.
Yeah,
I'm trying to knock it on the head, but have to have a couple every day for my own health. It's
I think, you know, controlling triggers, you know. Yeah. So maybe alcohol is involved. You know, after three drinks, you start searching for that itch of having to sleep with somebody, find somebody in a non-intimate way where you're still in control of things. But it is that, you know, real fear of that intimacy and loss of control through the intimacy, which is really, as I say, makes it very complicated.
Yeah, I think one of the things that helped tell that story or put that on the next level was something you touched upon briefly, and the intimacy between the cameraman and the actors. There was such a closeness and warmth. There was a lot of not traditionally framed shots, even just really being in the scene, like very breast on, kind of breaking that boundary, not just filming. Here's our perfect background scene. Just getting in and moving around and feeling like
you shouldn't be in the room.
Yeah, completely. You're at any minute you're going to turn around and go, well, excuse me, can you leave, please?
What, I'm trying to masturbate here.
Yeah, exactly. Can you? This is uncomfortable.
Yeah,
but how is that as an actor then? Because that is, again, it must be a very intimate a relationship over that time with the cameraman, because you're having to lose yourself in that performance and forget that they're there, but they're having to be very close to you and very, you know.
Well, that's engaged. Why, you know, for me, you know, the director obviously is the key component.
Yeah.
But I very much find with the cameraman, it's a very, or camerawoman, it's again a very important relationship to have that understanding and to be comfortable with one another and to understand the rhythms of one another and the distance. How far from the camera should I be? You know,
and that trust. It must be a huge amount of trust in that you can focus on your performance and they're going to capture it.
Well, it's also, I mean, you're aware of them. Yeah. You know, it's rather than going, they don't exist. I'm very much aware the camera is there.
Right.
And then I sort of, you know, and then it's about that relationship with the camera, and you develop a rhythm with one another. And like, for example, because a lot of the times, you know, as you said, Steve, Sean Bobbitt's got the camera on his shoulder.
Yeah.
And we're moving. Like, so for example, the scene in 12 Years a Slave, where Epps is whipping Patsy.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's a oneer. So to let Sean know in a movement that I'm going for the gun, so he knows that the camera's going down to the gun, to give little hints of a movement. So, you know, if I'm getting up, I don't get up immediately.
Yeah.
I make a sort of move to show them that I'm going to get up, and then he's primed and ready for that, and you can move in sync together. And it's like a dance.
Yeah.
And that's really enjoyable.
That's amazing you're giving each, that everyone is giving everyone cues as such. It's not the director or the AD just going, and now you're giving a cue to the cameraman who's giving a cue to over there, that there's going to be this movement. And it's
the focus puller too. You know, you don't want to do something really sort of, you know, abrupt or totally unexpected. It's nice to have unpredictability for sure, because that creates an energy also. Yeah. But it's not always great when they miss it. So so you wanna make sure that you're giving them little hints.
Yeah, yeah. So another thing that it seemed you left it a while in your career before pulling out a little trump card of speaking German. Being a handy addition in Inglourious Basterds and indeed in X-Men First Class, that was a really helpful thing to have in your back pocket, right?
It was for sure.
To call upon.
I was for sure, but I had to do a lot of work. I have to say, my German's pretty poor. I'm ashamed to say. And also again,
sharpen these tools. I guess.
Yeah. Definitely had to work a lot on the Inglourious Basterds stuff in particular, because it was such a long scene. And also, you know, Quentin was such a huge hero of mine, as I say, from Reservoir Dogs.
In a Reservoir Dogs play,
it was right at the beginning for me. So,
How was that then to get that from when you, when you directed a Reservoir Dogs play, and then all your mates have left, and you've kind of thought, am I going to work in hotels? To 15 years later, maybe, or whatever it is, I'm being directed by.
Those are the incredible moments, you just think, wow, so lucky, the dice rolled the right way and in the right place. And then, of course, to make the most of that opportunity when you're in that place, but to get the opportunity, you know. And I've got to say, my agent, Michael Cooper, really pushed for that Inglourious Basterds job and really fought to get me in the room. But I was preparing for Landa. That's the funny thing, because I was doing Fish Tank at the time.
Yeah.
So I was going in with sort of, not having a script for Fish Tank, so preparing that on the sort of day-to-day basis.
Wow.
And then the Inglourious Basterds script came my way. So they were like, "We want you to take a look at Landa and Hickox." And I was like, "Well, I can't cover both here." So I just put all my eggs in the Landa basket.
Yeah.
And then I arrived in the audition and Quentin was like, "Okay, let's take a look at Hickox." And I was like, "What about Landa?" And he's like, "I cast Landa on Tuesday." And I was like, "Really?" I was like, "Come on, give me a go." He's like, "I've got my Landa, okay?" And I was like, "Sure, no problem.
Okay,
let's read Hickox." And it was pretty much a cold reading. So I came out of that audition thinking, "Oh no, I've blown it," you know. And luckily enough, a week later or 10 days later, I got the call and I was on board.
Yeah, that's amazing. Have there ever been any, or is it a regular thing that you get any roles that you nail it and you book it, and then you have that panic of, am I up to this? I'm suddenly working with Quentin. It's amazing to chase it, but then there must be a level of fear when they go, "Oh, you've got it," and you're like, "Oh, right. I've got to do this now. Whoops. I've got to follow through."
No, definitely always, I have moments, doubt is there, you know. And a healthy dose of that, for sure. And especially in the preparation time by myself when I'm working on things at home. And it's really only to the first day that you get on set that you're going to go, okay, now it's time to show them whether, I'm on target here or way off. And that first day is always a little bit like, have I got this right? Thing is, with Quentin, he does a lot of rehearsals as well.
Right.
And thankfully, he was really, we saw the character the same way. Plus, he gives very clear indications where that character's coming from. So it's like, this character is based on George Sanders.
Yeah.
So I just went out and watched all the George Sanders material I could get.
Amazing, yeah.
And, that's the thing about, great directors. They will give you the tools you need. And then it's clarity, whether you go off and do the homework or not.
Yeah.
And, again, with Quentin, you better do the homework. Because if you come to work unprepared, it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah, and he's someone who's going to know every character inside and out.
Absolutely.
And all of he's known for his references. So
that's right.
Be deeply ingrained in his childhood, in his history. So
he's got a character that might have two lines, but he knows that character you know,
yeah,
where
yeah,
their
yeah.
whole trajectory is. And that character might turn up in another film somewhere else, you know, or the brother, you know, the Vega, you know, Vincent Vega and Michael Madsen's character. Yes. Aren't they? They're brothers, aren't they?
Yeah.
So, you know, he loves and knows his characters so well. Like I say, even if it's the smallest of character, he's got so much love for it. He wants to see you invest the same into it. You know?
Be in there. So I'm a massive a comic book fan, and I think we're in a great place with comic book movies now, because I think in recent years they've realised that comic book isn't, or superhero isn't the genre. It's a plot line. And so we've got, like, Ant-Man was essentially a rom-com and Logan was a Western, but it felt like it started with X-Men First Class, which felt like a Bond movie kind of thing. It didn't. It was the first that didn't feel like it was going, the story is that they're superheroes. It was like, no, the story is everything else. Part of the plot is that they're superheroes, but that wasn't the be-all and end-all.
That's correct. You know, I think that was, you know, Matthew Vaughn was very... you know, that was his vision with it.
Yeah.
And I think he was very clear that that's how he wanted to approach it. But I guess, you know, the first X-Men, the very first one that Bryan Singer did, that really kind of kick-started this whole sort of, you know, superhero thing.
Completely.
Of course, there was always Spider-Man and Superman.
Yeah.
But to really get the sort of comic book genre going, I guess, it, you know, it's
in that way of the huge box office as well, and, continuing on was it started with that. So how was the pressure then to step into
video game territory,
to step into the boots of McKellen? Where they have set that out, and you're going, well, now we're going back.
Yeah,
how was that?
Well, it's good. You know, I like those sort of pressure things where, you know, you have somebody of Ian McKellen's, you know. He's one of the greats.
Yeah,
of course. You know, I was first off very flattered that I was sort of chosen as the young version of him.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, you better do it justice because he's such a phenomenal actor.
Yeah, yeah. So,
but that pressure is good, you know. And also the pressure of... The great thing about comic book fans is they're so passionate. 100%. And, you know, you go to Comic-Con, you see that. And they're very vocal.
Yeah.
And they're honest about their how they feel that they're this... world that they're so close to and feel so connected to is being handled in the right way.
That's it. I was going to say, you describe it as the great thing because you're in one of the ones that got it right.
It's
the not great thing in the ones that aren't, because they are very vocal and very angry about things when,
that's right.
when things don't go right.
But
so,
you know, that's going to happen too. You know, if you're going to roll the dice and risk things, and, you know, I think only through risking things you really learn thing. You know, learn your craft or get an experience out of it is by taking the risks.
Yeah.
They don't always land. Yeah. You know?
So, I mean, we've spoken of the pressure there. How was the pressure then? Stepping into, after a long time waiting, the return of Alien and a Prometheus and then Covenant. How was that to be?
Well, you know, again,
right, thrown in the middle of all that.
Mm. I mean, you know, when the call came in for Prometheus, the first thing, you know, was like, wow, working with Ridley Scott.
Yeah,
and I was shooting X-Men.
Yeah,
when Ridley was at Pinewood scouting the studios. And I saw him.
And this is highlighting what I'm saying about you've not had a day off in this 10-year
period.
Everything's I was shooting this when this came in, and then I was shooting that. Yeah.
No, it happened like that. It was hop, 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 hop. Yeah, you know. Yeah. And I just remember going, God, that's Ridley Scott over there. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah.
And then I was on set with him, and it was the first day, and I was really quite intimidated, you know. And he's just such an easygoing guy.
Oh, really?
He's such a relaxed director, generous. We have so much fun. We've become really close friends. And sort of, so absolutely that first experience with Prometheus. I remember, actually, I was doing, just before Prometheus, I was doing Shame. So Shame came in between.
Right, yeah.
And I remember Steve was going, you just got to have fun for sure. He's like, you must have fun with this.
Yeah,
just go and enjoy it. So that's, you know, day one, Prometheus got on like a house on fire with Ridley, and we just... had a lot of fun shooting it. So coming back to Alien, I was really excited to get into it.
Yeah.
And to reprise David again. I had fun with that character. And
to play with the character in Covenant, because there was multiple versions of the, do you know what I mean? You got to really have fun with that kind of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's see the different other directions I want
to take him in. Step back as myself.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'll wrap things up now and just ask kind of what's ahead. I know there's more Assassin's Creed up.
I don't know, actually.
You don't know?
I don't know if there will be.
No?
I haven't heard anything
from
Ubisoft. They've gone very quiet.
All right. So are you looking at a bit of a gap and some time off? Or, I mean, I don't know if it'll be on the table yet, but a reprise in your role as Harry Hole in further ones. Obviously, there's teasing in there. There's potential for many more.
There's plenty of books, great stories there. Like I say, I really enjoyed playing the character. I really have a lot of love for the character. So absolutely, I'd be up for going again.
Amazing. Well, thank you very much for your time, and enjoy a bit more time off. You know, do a bit more surfing and drive a few more cars.
For sure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. How was that? I hope you all enjoyed that. A few people, when I had James McAvoy on and when I had Eddie Izzard on, are always nervous. And I get nervous of it when it's a press junket, because the fear is that it's going to be a bit... The thing people tend to like about this podcast is how relaxed it is and how much we get into other things rather than just promoting a one film. I think that you'll have seen from this episode that this is kind of how I should be doing them. Like, that was 45 minutes of straight to the point, raw power, and we got through everything. We covered a lot of ground. But what I should mention again, that The Snowman comes out on October 13th in the cinemas all over the UK, so give that a look. So if this is your first time listening, the other podcasts are basically that, but just not as tight, just spread out a bit more rambly, more of me talking over people. It's not really, but some people say that, because if I'm excited, we get all jumpy, and if I don't know, New York, let me tell you about that. So I had, originally it was meant to be a week in LA and a week in New York to have meetings on the acting front and to do some podcasts. But because this podcast came in, I had to cut it short. So I had, I guess, 3 days in LA and three in New York, or three and a half. I don't know. A day of travel, essentially, to get from LA to New York. And LA was amazing. I had loads of really good meetings. Man, I'm lucky to be getting in rooms with some of these people. I'm 3 years into a blooming acting career, and I'm getting to sit down with insanely big casting director. It's amazing. I won't go into any of it because it will bore you, but I finished every day out there just with the biggest smile on my face, and went back to my Airbnb just to prep stuff and prepare for the next day and things like that. So it was a lot of fun. And then I went to New York, and I had 1 day spare because I was meant to have some meetings and they fell through. So I walked around for 6 hours and took some photos and posted them on Instagram. I went to see a Brooklyn based film called Beach Rats, which is currently in my top 10 films of the year. I absolutely adored it. And then it turned out my old pal Stephen Graham was in New York by pure chance. He's out there doing a film at the moment, and the morning I woke up in New York, he posted in a group message that a few of us have got, just a picture of New York, and I was like, dude, I'm here too. So we met up and had a catch up, and that was lovely. And then I recorded two podcasts. I recorded one with Johnny Lee Miller, and that was amazing. We talk about Trainspotting 2. We talk about Trainspotting 1, for God's sake. Love on and Obey, Elementary, him moving to America, the ups and downs when the first Trainspotting went out, because he had a lot of hype. And by his own description and admission, he didn't necessarily behave perfectly at the time. So that's a really good one. And then I sat down with Jean Grey, and Jean was one of the first names on my list when I started this podcast, and we've just not been in the same country. If you're not familiar with Jean Grey, she's one of my favourite rappers of all time, and just we've got the same mind. It was spooky to sit down because it's the first time we've sat down together. We did a phone interview once on my radio show back in the day, and we interact a load over social media. But we sat down and had an hour and a bit of just going, yeah, our minds are the same. We're the same person in different places and upbringings and scenarios. So that's a really good episode. I can't wait for you to hear that. I'm not sure when that'll be out because I've got a few other guests lined up in the coming weeks that have kind of specific release dates that they need. So, you know, the way I do that is if I get a chance to meet with people, I'm never going to say no. But with Johnny and Jean, it's like, well, there's no rush to put them out. I've got the live podcast I need to put out still. So that'll be out in a couple of weeks. Yeah. So next week, I never normally speak of episodes before I've recorded them. But as you listen to this on Wednesday, I should be having or going and talking to Russell Howard. So that'll be out next week, probably. I'm not sure. I don't know. I've got a lot of guests I lined up. It's a bit mental at the moment with this trip. So I recorded Johnny Lee Miller and Jean Grey in the evening in New York. Then the next day, I flew overnight to London, drove straight from the airport to record this episode with Michael Fassbender. Then had a day to prep it all, send it off, and then go and record another one with a Russell Howard. And then there's meant to be two more beginning of the week after that. So it's all a bit crazy in the distraction pieces our world at the moment, but beautifully crazy. And it blows my mind that you guys are supporting and pushing these numbers through the roof. Again, this week's episode is an illustration, but if you saw the names I'm being approached about at the moment, it'd blow your mind. It's blowing my mind that this podcast started out as a list of people I'm either mates with or have got mates of mates and can get on some kind of contact with. And yeah, it's turned into a bit of a beast, and it's all down to you guys. So thank you very much for supporting. If you're new to this and want to follow me at Scroobius Pipio on Instagram and Twitter, facebook.com/ScroobiusPip. We've also got Distraction Pieces pages, so go and follow them, please. So the D Pieces Network on Twitter, Distraction Pieces Network on Instagram, and Distraction Pieces Podcast on Facebook. That's confusing, I know. Just have a hunt about. You'll figure it out. It'll be fine. I'm going to go now. I think that's everything I need to tell you. Have I missed anything? There's going to be... So I will be putting out the live podcast from Dublin. And the Hardcore Listing Lads will be putting out the live drunk cast from Dublin. So keep an eye on all of that. There's a lot going on. It's very exciting. And yeah, I'll see you all in a bit. speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I've gone weak on pushing that and now, haven't I? I admit it. I'm guilty of that. But I'm too busy to make money at the moment. I'm too busy creating free content and enjoying myself. So I'll get back on that hard sell soon, I promise. Oh, I will give a little plug now for my shoes. I did a collaboration with OHW Shoes. If you go to ohwshoes.com, you can check out the collaboration I did. Appreciate any support there. I'm really pleased with them and proud of them. I wore them as I walked for 6 hours around Brooklyn and Williamsburg and East Village and downtown Brooklyn and all over the place. So yeah, check it out. Anyway, I'm going to go because this is rambling and nonsense. I will catch you all next week, hopefully with a Russell Howard. If anything has gone wrong with that or there's a delay, fear not. I've got loads of good podcasts in the bag and loads more to come. See you all in a bit. Ta-ta.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.